Welcome back to those who listened to the first part of this episode. And for those who didn't, you might want to go back and start with part one. It was truly a pleasure to have these incredible students chat with us, as well as both Jordan and Dr. McDowell. These two episodes were like nothing we've ever done before, and I'm really glad we got the opportunity. If any of you are listening, thank you so much for being a part of this. To avoid holding the conversation up any longer, enjoy part two of our rocket-fueled episode. This is Breaking Bad Science. So, Jonathan, one of the things that these types of competitions, or I mean, I guess it's not a competition, I guess, but these types of programs, you know, end up having to do is deal with the agency that is a part of the thing. So what advice can you give to people dealing with actual NASA employees? I mean, I think, you know, if it was biological scientists, I have a pretty good idea of what a lot of those types of people are like. So what is it really like dealing with, you know, people at NASA who might be looking at what these kids are doing?
Right. And of course, you'll mostly be dealing with engineers rather than sure. scientists like me. You know, thinking back to my time at NASA Marshall in Huntsville and the sorts of engineers I met there. I mean, you know, the challenge is, can they, you know, they live stoichiometric ratios and pressure curves and all of these other jargony things. So, you know, don't be shy at getting them to explain terms, right? Because they'll probably forget, you know, you know, they'll use jargon that they think everybody knows, and of course everybody doesn't. NASA is also, you know, it's part of the government. And so even as, you know, engineers were, you know, want to just get it done, right? But they're constrained by the government regulations. And so you just have to be patient with the fact that there's going to be paperwork and there's going to be things that they say, okay, I'm allowed to do this, but not that. And it's totally out of your control, however senior you are in the organization.
Sure.
So those are the challenges, I think. But also, you know, remember that even if these people are, you know, engineers who are building the space launch system and about to shoot astronauts to the moon, they started off where you are.
Yeah.
They're space cadets at heart. And so they're excited about the fact that you're excited.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, that's one of the things that even in my science competitions in high school, you know, they'll match enthusiasm. You know, I mean, if you are truly excited about what it is that you're doing and what it is that you've done, I think it makes, you know, the people that you're presenting that work to a lot more excited about what it is that you've done.
You got to show that you're serious as well. You know, you've got to show that. And in particular, you got to show that you're very serious about safety. That's number one, right? And even a small rocket, you know, there are ways you can do yourself a mischief. So safety has to be the number one thing that you think around what can go wrong. And this is, you know, a lot of the way I live my life is sort of influenced by, you know, growing up at NASA. Actually, I didn't mention my dad was, did a sabbatical at NASA. He was a physicist.
Oh, wow.
I was a 7-year-old running around NASA Goddard the year before the moon landing.
Oh, very cool.
And so I've grown up with this. And so my whole life is, okay, what's the backup plan and what's the second backup plan and what else can go wrong? And what do I do if that goes wrong? A lot of planning in advance. And the thing that you really see if you watch, you know, Apollo 13 or you watch these other space movies, right, that are based on real stuff is the level of pre-planning that means when something goes wrong. You know what to do.
Yeah.
And that really came home to me actually that just this past week with this, we talked about the anti-satellite test. That the astronauts got woken up with the news that guys, sorry to wake you up so early, but you're about to fly through a cloud of shrapnel at 17,000 miles an hour, and there's a possibility that you know the space station could get punctured and
oh, stuff. Oh, man.
And so can you do procedure 1384.5 or whatever? And they're like, and they're, you know, if that were me and I would just woken up of sleep, I'd go, what? And they're like, no, okay, copy 13845. I mean, they were just like totally, okay, so the first thing we do is this, and then we do that, and then just, they have a procedure for what to do if you might be about to die because you're about to get hit by something.
Wow.
Right? You know, and they train that procedure. And they know how to do it, and they just go through and do it because they know what, you know, they're prepared for it. And I think that is, if there's one less life lesson from doing rockets and working with NASA, that you can apply that to many aspects of your life.
Yeah.
That pre-preparation is the thing.
Well, and it's important to note that, you know, while astronauts are the people that get talked about, you know, the people that wrote that program that they needed to execute is, you know, are the engineers and scientists designed those things to begin with. And I think that's, you know, so just not enough people really understand how incredible it is to be the scientists and the engineers that develop those types of things.
Right. And I've been involved in that sort of thing on the ground for our Chandra satellite. Right. And there's no people on Chandra. So the worst thing that we can do with Chandra is we can toast $1 billion space observatory. Right. Still not good.
Right.
On $1 billion space observatory on which, you know, several hundred people's jobs depend.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we're going to do a new procedure to use the camera in a slightly different way, we have a whole fake Chandra on the ground that we run through, you know, sending the commands to, just in case we screwed up the command order.
Right.
And, you know, make sure, do all kinds of simulations to make sure that we're not going to introduce a fatal problem in the spacecraft. And so that is, and that's a really, and then when, you know, that moment when you command up, you know, you're sitting in the control center and you go, all right, let's send the command, right? And you wait to see what actually happens. That's
right. All right. So let's do a couple of things. We've already had quite a bit of time here, but I know Shanti was talking about being very interested in what the students were doing and sort of the concept of the program in general. So did you have any questions you want to ask them, bro? Anything? I mean, most of what they're saying is going over both of our heads, but there may be some questions that you have that we could understand the answer to.
You know what? No questions. I think it's you're all pretty badass. And, you know, one day when the lot of you become very, very prominent, important physicists, astrophysicists, or people in rocketry or whichever path you go, I'm just going to remember that I was on here with you. And I'm super excited to see what the future holds for each and every one of you. It's really awesome what you're doing.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you folks have a really good handle on what you're doing. And it's, you know, it may only be a little rocket going a little high, but it's exactly the same principles that we use on the bigger things. And so you're learning really, really applicable stuff. And that's great.
Yep. I guess I'll ask one thing. It was crazy when I found out that that essentially without any velocity, like in any direction, if somebody could essentially fall from the moon straight to Earth, so how much energy would it require to launch a rocket just enough off the Earth going in the other direction of the Earth's orbit of the sun to get the rocket to cancel out the orbit and just fall straight to the sun?
That sounds like a question for Google.
Yeah, man, we're going to 4,000 feet. We ain't going to space.
He has been...
Hey, listen, I have high hopes for you all. I think you all... I get you, though.
He has been on this question since our last conversation with Jordan almost exactly a year ago. So, what was that, Jonathan?
Delta V right there.
He can wait another year.
Yeah. So the Earth is going around the sun at 30 kilometers a second. And so you have to, if you want to fall toward the sun, you've got to kill that speed. So you have to go the opposite direction at 30 kilometers a second, which is, I don't know how many, I can't do that number in my head. Hang on, I'm going to do that for us. 30 times 3,600 divided by 1.609.
67,108 miles per hour.
Yes, thank you. 67,000 miles an hour. And so that is much faster than any space rocket currently can directly launch to. And that's the reason why. So my friends in the back in the office here are working on a mission called the Parker Solar Probe, which is trying to get closer to the sun than anyone has done before. And so what we did was we launched it into an orbit that just killed a bit of its velocity, so it fell in toward Venus. And we targeted it so that then Venus took away a bit of its velocity with its gravity, so it fell even further in. And we're passing it by Venus every few months. So each time it loses a bit more speed and dips in closer to the sun. And so now we're getting it really close to the sun, to the point where we have this big carbon fiber heat shield protecting the instruments. And if we made a mistake and turned it the other way around, the whole spacecraft melt. A lot of people don't realize it actually takes less energy to get from the Earth to outside the solar system entirely than it does to get from the Earth into the sun.
Wow.
Right? It's less velocity change to go from our 30 kilometers a second to escape than it is to go from 30 kilometers a second to zero and fall into the sun. So getting to the sun is actually really hard.
Wow.
Yeah, we talk a little bit about that. And most of these kids are in the rocketry class as well. And the analogy we always use is it's like a tetherball. You know, it's swinging around the center pole. And if you want to hit the sun, you have to stop the ball and let it fall. Right. Versus it's pretty easy to speed it up or slow it down a little bit and tap it in the right direction, forward and backwards. But if you want to like shoot your garbage into the sun as your catch all solution to civilization's problems, not going to work that way. I had another question. I can't remember what it was. It's gone. That's it.
Well, that was going to be what I was going to say is before we end this, is there any questions that, you know, you guys wanted to ask that? I'm definitely realizing that there's no way I can answer anything, but maybe this is your opportunity to get, you know, Jordan to actually answer a question for once, or, you know, we have, Dr. McDowell here who also has a pretty significant amount of experience in the industry. So,
I do have a question, Dr. McDowell, because our payload does deal with, brain damage in a rocket flight. And you said you have, your job is recording rocket flight sent off. Is there any, has there been any records of brain damage in people going on that?
Well, that's an interesting question. What I know is, you know, most of the study has been about radiation damage from going in space, but damage from accelerations, I'm not aware of anyone having studied that. So I think they just try and, you know, I'm sure there's research, aeromedical research on that from airplane flights and airplane crashes and, ejector seat designs and things like that. And probably what I would guess is NASA has used that information to kind of guide their design of crew cabins. The other thing I do know they do is, they do, of course, do lots of acceleration measurements, particularly for rockets that are carrying microgravity payloads that are trying to use, do like chemical reactions and make pure drugs and things like that using the absence of gravity or quote, you know, free fall really, right? And the thing is that if you have accelerations, that can mess up those chemical reactions. And so you want as quiet an environment as possible. And so they do a lot of work in studying what does the payload feel, but not from a biological point of view. And so I think there's relevant data, but not quite the same thing that you're doing.
That's really good. No, thank you.
Yeah, it might be worth looking into, you know, just for sort of background data for your report is looking into some of the things where, you know, like he said, airplanes and some of those concepts, because I know some of the things that they have a problem with is and do have a fairly good understanding of is when G-forces can reach a certain point that causes people to black out. And I assume there is some sort of similarity to what you're looking for in that case is that it is that, although usually that's some sort of rotational, I think, acceleration that tends to have that effect. But, you know, there may be some research around that concept.
Yeah, I know they looked at, you know, kind of just medical like concussion testing and like athletes and things like that, but kind of had a tough time getting much traction. They reached out to a few emails there and some different kind of doctors and concussion researchers and didn't really hear much back. We had one kind of connection through the Oregon Rocketry Club, a guy who had a niece that was involved in some level of that wanted to kind of reach out to us, but we haven't really followed up with that.
Oh, interesting.
The other thing I would say on the note of kind of the problem, the project in general that you know, Dr. McDowell mentioned about how it's like the safety aspect and the risk analysis. You know, when we went into this project, that was probably the biggest unknown for me as an educator, was that, you know, I was familiar with building rockets. I can teach kids how to build rockets and the physics behind it and all of that all day long. I don't really have a problem with that or the machining or the making or any of that. But they wanted a formal risk analysis, you know, a hazard analysis of what are all of the things that can go wrong and what is the result. It's a very structured thing as well. You know, hazard due to blank results in blank. And then they want a mitigation plan and a verification plan after that. And, you know, moving forward in the years to come, you know, we punched a 2-year ticket to this challenge. So we have this year to do it, and provided we complete, we can do it again next year. But even moving forward, if this doesn't maintain something that we remain eligible for, I think that in general is probably something that I'll be incorporating into my class moving forward. You know, it might not be a 6 or a 7-page list like it is in right. This case, incredibly detailed. But just that concept of what can go wrong and what is your plan to handle it when it does, I think is a really, really, really important valid exercise. That's been really good. There have been a lot of things that I've taken away from this process in general that, like I said, even if the future, if I trim the paperwork a bit, there's a huge amount of validity in this process that I'm learning a lot as an educator. I'm really grateful for it.
I actually have a question for Dr. McDowell. Now, you grew up in the world of science. You've been in astrophysics for decades, and, you know, within your day job of finding black holes and of using the Chandra telescope and just kind of exploring all this, I'd imagine that, like, for me, there's a lot of novelty with these subjects because it's all new to me. So everything's so cool. I spend so many hours on YouTube researching black holes, white holes, all these cool concepts. What is the one thing that to you, having so much exposure to it, still drives like a ton of curiosity and still kind of piques your creative mind, if you will, within the sciences?
Well, you know, there's always something new. That's the thing. There's you know, every day I read the archive, which is the website where all the new papers come out. And what I look for is not just new objects discovered, like, oh, they found another black hole or they found another white dwarf star, but new kinds of objects. Oh, that's a new one. I haven't heard of this. And sometimes it's just a slight difference. Like, this is a star with a chemical composition that's got a lot of barium in it. We haven't seen that before. Well, it's mildly interesting, but, you know, make a note. And sometimes we get these things so recently. They discovered this thing called fast radio bursts, and there's a big mystery about what they were. And now there were actually two kinds that they saw. So, okay, these fast radio burst signals, what are they? And it turned out one kind was a new way that a star dies, that it's a star collapsing, and the shock wave as it collapsed goes through sort of gas that already escaped from the star and triggers this big burst of radio static that you can see incredible distances across the universe. The second kind turned out to be that next on the radio telescope, there was the graduate student kitchen with the microwave oven. And if you turn the microwave oven off without closing the door, that generated some radio static.
No way.
That's ridiculous.
Was it really?
And so that was why only that telescope had seen that type of fast radio burst. You know, you can get caught either way, right? But one of them turned out to be a really interesting discovery, right? And the other one, not so much. So you know, that's always, there's always some new way of thinking about the universe and realizing, understand, and for me as well, also, it's like big picture views. One of the things that came, you know, to me a few years ago as I look back on my career is that we used to think the universe was mostly about stars, and stars shine by nuclear fusion. When you look in the sky with your eyes, what you see is light coming from nuclear fusion reactors. That's what stars are. But now we know if you look in X-ray light, what you see mostly is not stars. You see light from matter falling into black holes. And the energy is being created by gravity, by the gravity of the black hole. So they're like gravity reactors instead of fusion reactors. And so that new way of looking at the universe, that energy in the universe is not just fusion light, it's also gravity light, was an insight to me that made me sit back and go, oh, okay, now I have a new way of thinking about of how to organize the universe in my mind.
Yeah, we considered doing an episode on fast radio bursts, and now I'm kind of disappointed in the result. I was really hoping for something more exciting.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, exploding stars is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So do you spend a lot of your time saying, relax, guys, no, it's not aliens?
Oh, so much time. Yeah. Oh, yeah, no. I mean, it's honestly, and that's the thing. And here's my thing, if any of you are tempted to think that it's aliens, right? Is I mean, certainly about all the UFO stuff, you know, or UAP as they say now, is you know, if the aliens come, right, they're going to have better technology than us. So either we're not going to see them because they're going to sit off, you know, a long distance. I mean, if our spy satellites can like read car license plates, right, so can the aliens. Right. So they don't need to come in close, right, to see what they want to see. So if they come in close, they're going to want to be seen. So either you're not going to see them, or they're going to be on, you know, Colbert, and you know, they're going to be doing interviews on all the evening talk shows, and it's right. going to be like Independence Day. You know, there's going to be like 10-mile diameter spaceships hovering over our major cities and stuff like that. It's not going to be subtle,
right?
Right. Yes. And so I think that's the main thing that is. It's like, no, there's just no way that they kind of subtly are skulking around. They're good enough that you just won't see them if they're not trying to be seen.
And then to follow up on that, have you ever watched the History Channel and had a facepalm moment when you saw one of the commercials for the many ancient aliens shows they have there?
I just had it when they advertised the History Channel on other channels. Yeah. Enough for me to go, no, I don't think I need to turn to that. Yeah. So a lot of those Picard facepalm memes. I have no word. There's a lot of stupid stuff out there.
Yeah.
And it's too bad because there's a lot of amazing secrets of the universe that we are revealing, right?
Yeah.
And there's incredible stuff to get excited about. And unfortunately, yeah, people get excited about the stupid stuff.
Yeah. So, well, that's the point of the podcast, is to try and get people a little more excited about stuff that's real instead of only being excited about what isn't real science. So
what you're saying is that ancient aliens is not a credible source. Got it.
Yeah, I think you want to treat it with just a little bit of skepticism.
Yeah, yeah. If if there is only one takeaway from this episode, I feel like that's it.
Yeah. The other thing about aliens you've got to remember, right, is the time scales in the galaxy. The galaxy is billions of years old. And so, you know, if you think about, if I go outside and meet someone in the street, what's the probability that they're going to be not just the same age as me, but was born on exactly the same day? You know, that's pretty, you'd be pretty surprised. Paired notes about you had exactly the same birthday. So the equivalent of that in galactic terms, right, is the first aliens you meet, you know, being within a million years of your level of development, right? They're either going to be millions of years behind us, not so interesting, or millions of years ahead of us.
Yeah.
Just from the fact that the probability that they're right where you are is so unlikely because of huge time scales of evolution. And so I think, you know, so they're not going to be Klingons. They are going to be, you know, they're either going to be ants or gods, right?
Right.
And that's the other thing to bear in mind.
All right. Well, this has been an extremely long episode for us comparative to what we've done lately, but, we have done this length before. So, I do appreciate everybody being on here and, you know, getting together to do this episode. I hope it was, you know, good for the students and great, you know, it's always great to hear from Jordan. And we can't thank you, Dr. McDowell, enough for being on here. You know, it's a pleasure to have, your insight and your knowledge base, not just for the students, but for, you know, Shanti and I as well. We struggle enough just trying to figure out basic science. So we appreciate you being on here as well. So with that, did anybody else have any other questions that they were burning to get answered before we sign off?
Hopefully nothing more about aliens.
All right. Thanks, guys.
I just want to wish the students the very best of luck with their launches. I hope you have a fantastic time and have all success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just thanking for having us today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thanks, everyone. Yes, much appreciated for your time there. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Good luck. Good luck, guys.
Thank
this has been
Bye.
Breaking Bad Science. Breaking Bad Science. Except the squishy.